warmer weather is here, and so are the creepy crawlies. Mosquitoes, ticks, chiggers, and the spotted lanternfly can wreak havoc on us and in our gardens. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, our experts will talk about the best way to keep these pests at bay. And, of course, they're here to answer your questions for the full hour. Joining me now are University of Kentucky Assistant Professor of Extension Entomology, Jonathan Larson. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. University of Cincinnati Interim Dean for Natural Sciences, Teresa Cully. Thanks for being here, Teresa.
Oh, certainly. Glad to be here.
And Civic Garden Center Environmental Education Specialist, Luis Aguilar Dwyer. Thanks for being here, Luis.
Happy to be back.
Glad to have you back. If you've got questions for them about your landscape or garden, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Jonathan, summer is mosquito season, and there is a grassroots effort called the Itty Bitty Mosquito Population Committee in Washington, D.C. that I've been reading about. They've got recommendations for how neighbors can band together to get rid of mosquitoes, and I want to talk about their suggestions. We all know getting rid of standing water is important, but they've got a suggestion for treating standing water using BTI and kind of luring mosquitoes into it. What do you think of that?
I think it's an interesting idea. I love the idea of creating like a little honeypot trap for them to lure them in and to kill their babies as they hatch out. Nobody feels too much remorse for destroying mosquito populations like that. And I think that the bigger part of the story that is interesting to me is the community aspect. It is true that you can do things individually to try and manage mosquitoes on your property, but they're pretty strong flyers. So if your neighbors aren't taking any of the same measures, you could be just sort of like spitting into the wind and not really gaining the control that you want. So getting a lot of people on board, making a grassroots effort, I think it has a lot of potential. And so I'm intrigued to see where this goes in the future.
Huh. Well, I read, Jonathan, that it's better not to spray insecticide because the mosquitoes become kind of immune to it and it kills off insects that eat mosquitoes. Is that right?
So there is some problem potentially when you spray insecticides with mosquitoes and resistance. We've used a lot of insecticides against mosquitoes for decades, and they have such quick generation times that this can contribute to sort of a genetic drift where if there is a mutant that is born or if there's a population that has sort of a pre-existing ability to detoxify things, you can wipe out their competition, and then the only genes that are left are these resistant or somewhat resistant genes, and the new populations won't be able to be managed the way that they used to. It doesn't just happen with mosquitoes. We see it with aphids and tons of other insect pests. We put this pressure on them, and then they conform to this pressure by sometimes becoming resistant. Mosquitoes have been able to do this before historically, and so it is true that we want to be wary of that. And usually that's achieved by switching between different classes of insecticides. So using multiple products against them within a season. But then even that is not going to eliminate the other problem that you mentioned, which is potentially harming natural enemies that might eat mosquitoes, potentially harming pollinators that may be visiting the same area. Mosquitoes hang out in vegetation where some of these pollinators may be visiting and trying to nectar. And if you're trying to control the mosquitoes on the undersides of leaves, you could also leave residues behind potentially that could harm those other insects as they come crawling through or flying through.
Teresa, I see you nodding your head in agreement. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's great information. I was always so just the basics of people should also check in their yards just to make sure there's not standing water. So, for example,
Unless they're going to poison the water well for the mosquitoes. Yeah.
So that's the first thing I do in my yard because I definitely do not like mosquitoes. And so I try to find any standing water that might be there. Water barrel that perhaps has been sitting there for a very long time and I haven't put anything in it. Definitely want to double check those types of things.
Yeah. So I heard this story on NPR, plug for the national network here, about some mosquitoes being attracted to DEET, like the mosquito repellent that you put on, because they smell it and they're like, ooh, there's a tasty human blood meal there. And so they're like going for it. Jonathan, have you heard about this, that some mosquitoes are just grinning and bearing the repellent so they can go ahead and get to the meal?
Yes, I have seen some of the science communication about that, about how it's telling them, oh, there is a host on the other side of this detrimental smell. And if they can just, yeah, like you said, grin and bear it, I actually really like that. If they can get through it, then they're almost guaranteed to find blood on the other side of it. So I don't think that it's super prevalent at this time, from what I understand. And it's not like a wholesale switch in the population where DEET is now a complete failure against mosquitoes. But it could potentially shift something in the future. And I think it shows, again, insects are very adaptable. And when we put these pressures on them, there's always a chance that they could change something, and then they end up becoming attracted to the things that we thought they were most appalled by.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a lot of wisdom for a tiny little mosquito brain, isn't it? Like to figure that out.
Yeah, it would have to be like pressure on them to. I don't know how to explain this. Like, they're not learning. I don't want to sound like I'm saying, like, oh,
Okay.
Grandpa Mosquito figured this out and told grandkid Mosquito that this is what's going on. It's more of a, there would be some sort of genetic shift where one of them was mutated, or it had a random adaptation that told it, oh, this isn't such a bad smell, or that it doesn't get bothered by the smell as much. And so then they are more successful because they're finding hosts, or that genetic trait is going to get passed on into the future. And there could be newer populations that are also not as repelled by the smell anymore of DEET.
Wow. It's like some people like cilantro and some people don't like cilantro. That could be
Yeah.
the
Oh,
whole
man.
the mosquito equivalent. Well, Teresa, this group also says that invasive plants attract mosquitoes and that native plants will help keep them out of your yard. Have you found that? Do you have any recommendations for like a plant that can kind of keep mosquitoes at bay?
That's fascinating. No, I haven't heard of that particular statement. However, there's plants like citronella plants or things that have very sweet fragrances, and those are frequently sold. I have used those around my own yard. I will say that I am especially susceptible to mosquitoes, and that's something that's always fascinated me because I could go out in my backyard and I will be zapped by mosquitoes, and I could be with other people who will not have them. Also, when I was pregnant, I was especially susceptible. And so that's always fascinated me as well as to why someone is attractive or not. But getting back to your question of plants, I do believe there are some plants. Some of them are, I'm trying to think, Louise, what that plant is. If it's, it almost looks like a geranium type of plant. I'm trying to think of what family it is. So.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not 100% sure of that one particular plant that you're referring to, but in terms of wanting to mitigate having like any pests in your garden, I think leaning on having like native plants in your garden can definitely bring a lot of those predatory animals that would control those mosquitoes. So let's say you have like a, garden backyard, and you have a pond, and you have, koi fish or whatever kind of fish in there. Gosh, we have fish in our pond at work, and we're like, oh, who's replenishing that? But ultimately, if we're providing habitat for like dragonflies, especially for mosquitoes, I mean, I've put citronella candles, I'll do the whole thing. I won't do DEET. I won't go as far as that. Now that I know that maybe they're attracting me, I go the holistic route. But yeah, I would, for that, I think if you're trying to mitigate it, bring the predators of those mosquitoes that you don't want. So I'm a big fan of dragonflies and bats and many of those wonderful animals.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I was just going to say bats. And so you had mentioned that as well. A lot of people think of bats as vermin or carrying rabies, which they can carry rabies, that is true. But bats are a hugely, if that's a word, important for us in terms of they feed on the mosquitoes. And so you actually want to have bats around. It's a healthy ecosystem if you have that. And I like your idea of making sure that you have natives in your yard. That's definitely true. If you have that biodiversity of insects, good insects and animals and, birds that will take care of the mosquitoes.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, one more mosquito question for you, because Teresa brought up this great point about how she is extra tasty for mosquitoes. I myself have that problem. I've told my husband it's because I'm sweeter than he is, and he doesn't believe me, but that's my assertion there. What is a person to do if there are mosquitoes in the world who are seeking out DEET now, knowing that you're on the other side? Like, what are your recommendations? Or do you have any recommendations that work for everybody to keep them off super sweet people like me and Teresa?
Well, just to speak on attraction slightly, mosquitoes, you know, they smell you from downwind. They are able to detect with their little antenna. The female mosquitoes are seeking blood hosts in order to get this blood meal. The male mosquitoes, they're pollinators. They actually don't attack humans. And so the female mosquitoes are downwind of you. They're able to detect your CO2 production and they fly towards you. Then they can detect your sweat and kind of your skin and your warmth. And then when they land on you, they can detect several other things. They can even detect your blood type. Past research has shown that mosquitoes have a preference for type O blood over the others. I'm not sure why, but there is data that supports that. There are some people who are just sort of naturally more attractive to mosquitoes. And some of that comes down to how much you sweat, how much you breathe, or how hard you breathe. People who are overweight or people who are pregnant also attract a lot more mosquitoes because they produce more signal that tells them to come over. And then people who have been drinking also are more attractive to mosquitoes, presumably because your blood is thinner and you're easier to dine on. The milkshake doesn't get stuck in the straw, so to speak.
I feel so seen right now, John.
When you're talking about cutting down on attraction, that's difficult to do. The skin-based repellents are the things that we tell people to use. DEET is the standby. It's worked for a long time. This new research suggests that maybe we've been putting too much pressure on mosquitoes and they're adapting, but it still works for most people. Some people don't like the smell of DEET. They don't want to use it. So there are alternatives. There's picaridin in some products, and you can see these kind of usually in the bottom left corner on the front label of whatever repellent you're buying. So picaridin, there's IR3535, which sounds less like a mosquito repellent and more like a Star Wars droid, in my opinion. But then there's a more essential oil type that's called oil of lemon eucalyptus that a lot of people like as well. And there's good data to suggest that these last for somewhere in between 6 to 8 hours when applied to the skin. If you sweat a lot, you could sweat it off. Or if you get wet while you're outside wearing this, you should reapply it. Dry yourself off and then reapply it so that your skin is refreshed with it and you're still repellent. Those would be the best things to do when you're outdoors. And unfortunately, we can't cut down on the other things. We can't stop ourselves from sweating. We can't stop ourselves from exposing skin, really. But these repellents do help to cut down on attraction generally.
Jonathan, you just said something that I didn't know, that male mosquitoes are pollinators.
Correct.
So does that mean they're our friends? I mean, are they actually contributing to the ecosystem beyond just being like bat food?
It's a complicated web, right? It's a messier world than we want it to be in a lot of ways. And yeah, mosquitoes are no different than other creatures. Mosquitoes, we would never say that they are our allies because they're probably the longest term enemy that humanity has ever faced.
Wow.
Maybe save strong. For lice.
Dang, that's strong words, Jonathan.
We've built cities in places and not built cities in other places because of mosquitoes. You can go throughout history and you can point to huge shifts in culture and politics that boil down to mosquitoes. The Louisiana Purchase really only happened because Napoleon was like, forget about it. I can't beat yellow fever in the Caribbean, and there's too many uprisings down there. I'm just going to sell it all and forget about it. And then we get all of the middle part of this continent for our burgeoning nation back then. That's a whole rabbit hole that I won't go down. But yeah, I wouldn't say that they're our allies, but the males, they do pollinate. They visit flowers. They have big fuzzy antenna. I assume that they sound like a little hippie and they're like, hey man, I found some great clover over here. But they're not strong enough pollinators that we would say, oh, we can't eliminate mosquitoes. But it does make it more complicated than I think. It's not as black and white as people want it to be. If we just eliminate these wholesale from the ecosystem, there could be repercussions that we couldn't foresee.
Okay, well, we are going to continue our gardening show after a short break. When we come back, we're going to take a break from pests and talk about wine science. So stick around. This is Cincinnati Edition. Have you heard the news? Cincinnati Edition is hosting a special show on data centers on July 15th at noon, and you can be part of the audience at our studios in Evanston. It's free to attend, but space is limited. Register now at wvxu.org. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show and a panel of experts to answer your questions. My guests are University of Cincinnati Interim Dean for Natural Sciences, Teresa Cully, Civic Garden Center Environmental Education Specialist, Luis Aguilar-Dwyer, and University of Kentucky Assistant Professor of Extension Entomology, Jonathan Larson. If you have questions for them, and we know you do, call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Luis, we have some other pests to talk about today, but let's shift to something a little more fun and possibly attractive to mosquitoes, wine science. What is wine science?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. So if you like to enjoy a wonderful beverage at a vineyard or always like at a botanical celebration, I think like there's a wine for you. And I think for me, it's my, I love to blend a lot of the environmental biology and chemistry background that I have. And one of my first jobs here in Cincinnati was actually rectifying and finding a lot of wines that we have here in Ohio. And what I found out was that there's a lot of rich history about winemaking and wine science here that, you know, well, it was a the kind of the pioneers for winemaking actually happened here near the Ohio River Valley. And for what we know now, we found, you know, there's different chemistry in the soils in California. And now we have a lot of the things that are shipped in from there. However, what I like to share with people is that if you have your interest and you love to taste and sample and like to think about being like a little bit like a hummingbird and you want a flight of different things, there's a red wine, a white wine, rosés, and there's different blends for you. And coming back to the pests and invasive things that can deter that, the spotted lanternfly is one of the biggest things that, you know, a lot of vineyards have lost a lot of acreage and in terms of like their plant diversity for to be able to produce these, the wines that they have. If there's like a huge outbreak for spotted lanternflies, let's say this summer, well, you know, it will decimate their crops and it will decimate their winemaking abilities, but it will deter their sales probably. This is an estimate, but not just this year. It's actually for the foreseeable future.
Sure, because that wine has to age, right?
That's right. So depending on where it has to be aged and the barrels that they have to go in for the tannins to leach in and the quality of the taste that you'd like. Unfortunately, if they have a lot of these vineyards are they're local, they're small, and if they're depending on their crops to yield so much X amount of wine, they have if there's a huge outbreak for these spotted lanternflies. Well, gosh, like you know, 2026 was. You know, a time for them. And if you look at it, oh gosh, it would affect their 2031 sales. And I find that many people don't think of it like that. It's, but however, coming it back to like bringing this back to a local garden, we have one of our Camp Washington community gardens that we have. And when I first started at the Civic Garden Center, I actually started probably September 2024. And we had grape sorbet that was given to us as a snack and like you know as a welcome treat, and it was wonderful. It was great to have it. And then I asked a little bit late, maybe a couple of weeks ago, I've asked our staff, it's like, hey, how's the grape production happening, or do we get to have any more sorbet? And as a lighthearted, you know, ask, and you know, they're you know, we were told our staff member shared, no, actually, the spotted lanternflies came in, and we don't have our. You know, we don't have our vines anymore.
Womp womp.
But there's wonderful things that are growing in at the Camp Washington Garden. But yeah,
that's a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned kind of the history of winemaking here. Wasn't it Nicholas Longworth who had the vineyard on a hill overlooking the Ohio River? Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to, you mentioned the spotted lanternfly, another evil pest that we will talk about during the show if we have time. But how difficult is it to grow grapes to make wine yourself?
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work and it takes time and you need a lot of acreage. So what that looks like is that if you have a family farm with several acres, the chances of you making it produce even like 1 gallon of wine is high. However, there's a lot of work that goes into it. You have to have your soil quality that has to be really good. You have to have the right conditions for the variety of grapes that you're trying to grow. The native grape variety that we have in Ohio and in this region is the Riverbank grape. And in terms of like the Chablis and you have your blends, It is one of the unique experiences where there are a lot of local Ohio wineries that exist in addition to vineyards, but also we have many that exist in Kentucky. And I will say the one thing about exploring wine science is that you get to sample around. So there's a couple, I think, oh gosh, there's like one on the west side of Cincinnati. I'm blanking on the name for now, but you get a flight of wine. It is the biggest flight I've ever seen. It was like 16 samples.
You need a designated driver for that flight of wine.
Oh, I'll tell you, I probably just had a steak after that. I was like, I'm not moving. Yeah. But the part of it is that what's really neat is I'm a huge enthusiast on it as well, is that if you're sampling that flight of wine, it's also telling a little bit of you get a window into the world that they're in. You get to keep, as you continuously sample, you're also getting a little bit of the notes. Yes, the sensory analysis, you get to have the sweet, the tart, and explore your senses, but you're also getting to taste the history of that wine. And I will say, Nicholas Longworth, their wine that they had is no longer in operation. But there is one local winery that has adopted their recipe, and I'll have to come back to the name. It's in OTR. Oh, it's so close, but it is
a Revel?
No, it's not Revel, mm-hmm. which I love them too.
Yeah.
I believe it's a woman-owned winery, and they had brought back the historic Nicholas wine.
Okay. Nicholas Longworth wine. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Teresa, are there parts of the region where people have more success growing grapes if they want to give that a shot? I mean, I'm sure it all depends on the soil and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm thinking in past shows, we've always talked about the soil and about how the soil is so critical, the nutrients, the composition, what it looks like. Luis was correct that the variety is really important. You need to have a match between that. I'm thinking I live in Butler County and there's some vineyards up in that area. So I would say that for grape species, it's really important in terms of the microclimate is another thing you need to think about. So it's not just, it's on this side of town or that side of town. It's also, is it in a small sheltered valley? Is it next to a river? Is it up on a hill where it's going to be exposed maybe to more storms? Where is it going to get rain and water? That's important too. And so you have to think about all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, our producer Selena says her uncle used to collect blackberries from the woods when he was a little boy. He's about eight years old at the time. He'd collect blackberries from the woods down the street from his house with the neighborhood kids. And they would make blackberry wine. And that, she said, he made it look easy. That was blackberries, not grapes. Probably easier to find some. But it sounds like it's not like homebrew beer. It's more complicated than that. Is that right, Luis?
I believe it's the opposite for me.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So to brew beer, it's a lot. It can be intricate. And the reason I'm sharing that, and by the way, sidetrack, it is called Skeleton Root.
Oh, there you go. Okay, Skeleton that's root. Right. Okay, yay. Okay.
And they have a Catawba that they make. And when it comes to winemaking, you literally can see this in a conveyor belt. You have to harvest, like, let's say you have your grape varieties or you have your fruit, the sugar that you want to use. It is the grapes that you are using. You rinse them out, you make sure there's no pests, you blend them up in this mush, and then you just want to extract the liquid. What happens is that once you have your grape concentrate, the juice, what you would do is then you would add it into, let's say I have even, I don't even say like a mason jar, that's towards the end. Mm-hmm. Let's say I have a whole gallon bucket. You fill it up with water. You make sure it's purified in the best way possible. You add your grape concentrate. And then all you have to do is then add the yeast that is appropriate for you to brew or to yield your wine. So there's different varieties of yeast that are created for the best outcome for your wine. So let's say you have a red grape, there is a yeast specifically used for that. And what you'll do is that as your materials are all sanitized, really that actually takes a lot of time and practice. You want all your things to be neutral and clean and sterile. You have your water, your concentrate, and your yeast. You close the lid. And what happens is that if you have a little, not an air bubble, but you have like a air adapter that you add to it, so any CO2 escapes, you probably could leave it for maybe a week or longer, and then the fermentation already happens.
Mm.
So from there, if you have a gallon of wine, you would then transfer it over to a new bottle, because the reason you start with your homebrew, your homemaking at home, What that looks like is that all that CO2 is expanding. You don't want to make your home patch with glass. It would explode. And then you start from ground zero.
Wow. Okay. Well, Jonathan, we've had a nice little wine break, but let's get back to pests. I want to talk to you about ticks. Are you seeing a lot more of them in Kentucky this year?
I feel a little bit like I've gotten the short end of the stick here. They get to talk about delightful wine and notes of tasting and everything, and I get to talk about blood-sucking ectoparasites.
I mean, if you've got some kind of bloodsucker wine connection, you said that mosquitoes like people who are imbibing, so you did bring that to the party, but, you know.
I was trying to think of, like, a vampire or a Dracula joke. I don't know. Anyway, we'll find it along the way. Okay. We are seeing a lot of tick submissions through our county extension system here in Kentucky. And if you watch the news, you probably have seen that the CDC has commented that the admissions for tick-borne illnesses in ERs across the country has gone up quite a bit. And there's just a ton of concern about ticks. We find a lot of frightful people are asking questions about being exposed to ticks and the potential pathogens that may be hiding inside of them.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, we had a whole discussion about ticks specifically a few weeks ago, and I know that it is very worrisome for people. Why do you think we are seeing all these ticks, Jonathan? Do we have warmer winters to blame for these little bloodsuckers?
I think that there's a mixture of things, and that is part of the soup that makes this up, is that, yes, things are a little warmer now, so they're surviving better. Ticks, the different species of tick that we're exposed to here in the kind of Ohio River Valley region, people will most commonly be exposed to Lone Star ticks, as well as black-legged ticks or deer ticks, and then the American dog tick. Those are probably the common three that we're going to have intersect with our lives. And yes, if the winter is warmer, that will help them to survive more. We talked about invasive plants before. When we have all of these invasive plants kind of growing together in these little thickets, we can create a lot more harborage for them. Also harborage for some of their hosts. If you think about little mice and deer, we have more of those organisms as well. So there's more hosts for them to enjoy and to sup on and drink from. And then we're building into their world more. We continue to develop into the natural world, right? We build new subdivisions and other places. So we're interacting with their world a little bit more, I think, and we're being exposed to ticks more frequently. The other concerning thing that I've noticed over the last 2 to 3 years, at least, is there's also a lot of tick misinformation that's coming out and people kind of fear mongering on the internet. There's a really popular, or I shouldn't say really popular, there's a subculture on TikTok of people that will glue
TikTok.
Beans and things.
I see what you did there. TikTok. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah. they will glue beans and seeds to themselves and they'll sort of pretend that they're ticks. And then they'll pull them off of themselves and they'll like make these like large geometric patterns on their legs. But some people that are watching it, they don't seem to understand that they're not really ticks. And so people get terrified that they could walk outside and suddenly be infested with 1,000 ticks all over their leg that are color coordinated in concentric spheres on their leg. It supposedly is satisfying to watch them be plucked off and to like pretend that you're being deparasitized, I guess. But there's other people that have used that avenue, I think, to spread some misinformation about what ticks do.
That is so weird. I'm sorry. It's just, I try not to judge the people, but glue and seeds on, what the heck? Teresa, Jonathan just mentioned invasive plants being a place where ticks can kind of hole up. Is this another argument for having natives in our landscapes and gardens? I mean,
yeah, I think so. For me, and I'm sitting here, I was attacked by chiggers yesterday. So I'm not.
You used the word attack too.
It was attacked. I'm still itchy. Yeah. But if we think about ticks, in my experience, when I get them is when, as a botanist, I'm doing a lot of work in the forest or really in prairies, low brush, maybe up to your hips. And the fascinating things about some of these little critters is that they will actually perch on the edges, you know, and like these thickets, like Jonathan said, and they're waiting for their next meal to come along. And so It's, yeah. So any, I would say anything that you could do to plant natives to clear things so you don't have these huge brush piles that you're constantly walking by is important. And then also, there is evidence, of course, Jonathan mentioned that deer, you know, carry these around. I'd also say if you have a dog who goes running off into the woods, you do need to periodically check your dog. The first time I ever saw, I thought it was just like little, I don't know, bumps like on their ears and stuff. I thought it was just something natural until I had someone, I was working at a vet hospital at one point, and they just got almost like forceps, you know, and just started pulling them off. And then I realized, oh my gosh, those were ticks.
Yeah. Or dogs.
Yeah. So they.
One of the interesting things with dogs too is that we treat our dogs, right, frequently for fleas and ticks. And as a result, I've had clients, one of the most memorable interactions I've ever had, they brought me this thing, I think I have bed bugs, and they had this baggie and it was full of smaller things, and I put it under the microscope and I was like, it was ticks. Oh. And I had to say, I asked, where did you get these? Oh, my dog was in my bed and I woke up and these were crawling around in my bed. And I said, I have good news and bad news. You don't have bed bugs, but your dog has brought ticks into your house. So they couldn't feed on the dog. They were dropping off of the dog. And then they were in this person's bed where they could potentially have climbed onto them and bitten them. And I appreciate you talking about them waiting. Yeah, we call that questing. They sit at the end of these kind of branches and long branches of or blades of grass, and they just post up and put their front arms out and wait for somebody to walk by so they can shimmy up their leg and give them this creepy little hug and find somewhere to bite. They are
so creeped out right now. Oh my gosh. Well, oh gosh. Well, Teresa, you talked about prairies and being in the woods doing your work as a botanist, but getting ticks isn't just limited to like camping out. I mean, they're in urban green spaces now, right? I mean, they're becoming more prevalent in city parks and places like that, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So I would say anyone who is going into, you know, just an urban park, I mean, whenever you go run around, especially if you have kids running through the grass, especially if it's anything that's higher grass, you know, it's not a well-manicured lawn, it's always a good idea. You know, when you're done, you have to look down, you have to look especially at your paints, see what's there. I will tell you, when I do field work, especially now, one of the things that I do is, so first of all, full confession, I hate anything sucking my blood. So what
else? That doesn't make you a bad person, Teresa.
It's just gross. Yeah, that's one of the things that freaks me out. But what I'll
do. Your bodily fluids.
Yes.
You're in charge.
Mine.
Yeah.
I don't want to give it away. But I always wear long pants. That's one thing. And then I'll have hiking boots or something like that on, sturdy shoes. But I always have socks where I can pull them up and I loop them over the bottom of my pants. And so, honestly, I look like a total nerd. And then I've been
with... A fashion icon.
Yes, a fashion icon. Thank you. I've been with students, undergrad students, and they think I look crazy. But they're the ones who are pulling ticks off of them at the end of the day, and I usually am not. I also wear lighter colored pants if you can, because then you can see the ticks.
Nice.
I really appreciate you saying that, because yeah, we tell people to do that all the time. I want it to be considered tick forward fashion. Like we're being conscientious. This is happening. You have to be prepared. And if that includes having socks that go over the bottom of your pants, then so be it. I would rather look like a nerd and be a nerd than be a nerd whose bodily fluids are crawling around in the landscape.
Well, that could be fashion tick tock, right?
I know.
Yes.
Yeah. Luis, is that something you check for even when you're in the gardens at Civic Garden Center and outside doing the stuff that you do? Do you, is a tick check kind of part of your routine?
It is not. Oh. I picked up my career and I love the field work aspect. And I'm probably bragging. I'm in a spot where I don't have to be as often looking for ticks. But however, I will say, I think a lot of the work that I've done, a lot of field work and done a lot. So doing a lot of work all over the US, and mostly what I will say, I would, in some of my jobs, I led a lot of youth workforce development programs. And the one prior to my role now, I was leading a lot of high school students out to Cincinnati parks. So it involved going to Mount Storm. They were going to Mount Airy and several, and also with Great Parks and Sea Zoo and all over the place. And before they go out into the field, I think the best thing for me, I've learned from my experience, I will say I'm with Teresa here. I don't like anything like sticking to me. I've gone out with a quadrat, done a prairie survey. I love prairies, but I will bolt the moment I have something, even if it's like a grass, a blade of grass, like scratching it. I don't know. I will bolt. But what I have done is that with the high schoolers, you know, you really have to kind of literally spell things out in terms of for their safety, for their, you know, for their well-being. And, you know, for that regimen, we provided boots. We made it a requirement for them to wear long pants, long sleeves. And also, when applicable, if we know we're in a densely forested and densely populated area with like tall grass, we make it a requirement to have done added permethrin. Probably for me, it's probably the most effective personally to put out the sole of your boot. Or even like if you have your work boots, I spray them there. And I have colleagues that spray them on their clothes and let them dry out for the next day. I don't go that far because, again, I will flail. I will run.
You will fight back.
But not the Civic Garden Center. We don't have that often. Yeah. Well, knock on wood.
No kidding. I hope I haven't jinxed you. Well, we will be back to wrap up our gardening show after a short break. If you've got questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with today's gardening show. My guests are Civic Garden Center Environmental Education Specialist Luis Aguilar-Dreyer, University of Kentucky Assistant Professor of Extension Entomology Jonathan Larson, and University of Cincinnati Interim Dean for Natural Sciences Teresa Cully. They're here to answer your questions. You can give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So we're going to switch topics. But before we do, Jonathan, if someone listening to this show is horrified and they find a tick on themselves, what is the best way to remove that little bad boy?
We get a lot of questions about this because everybody's family has different methods that they've passed down, from pouring rubbing alcohol on it, or I've met people here in Kentucky that swear by pouring bourbon on it, or essential oils. I met one person who said that he put peanut butter on top of them in order to get them to come out. What we really want you to do, though, is to get a pair of tweezers with a finer tip and then get down as close to the head of the tick as possible, which will be inside of your skin area. And then you grip that and pull straight up. You don't want to rock the tick back and forth. You don't want to twist it around corkscrew style and try to get it out that way, because you could break bits of the tick off into your body, which can lead to further complications. There will be some resistance. Ticks have a specialized tongue with backward-facing spines that help to anchor them in place. So they can be a little difficult to remove, but if you put enough pressure, it will come out. And then we encourage people to keep the tick, to put it into a Ziploc bag or a pill bottle, put some rubbing alcohol in there afterwards, or put it in the freezer. And if after the tick bite you begin to express any flu-like symptoms, or if you develop any rashes near the bite site, you'll have the tick. You can take it with you to the doctor. They can identify the tick, or have somebody like me identify the tick, and then they'll know what possible pathogens you may have been exposed to.
And I assume you should wash that area very well after you, the area of your skin. Yeah.
Yes, there will be a hole there, so you should disinfect it as well.
Jonathan. Okay, we're going to talk about something else now, Teresa.
Please save us.
Yes, save me, Teresa. You've been doing some research on boxwoods, which has been a favorite topic on this program for years now. And you've been looking at which cultivars are most resistant to box tree moth. I guess we did get another bug in here somehow, but box tree moth. Are box tree moths still a big problem in greater Cincinnati?
They are. And so we have a whole test plot in Loveland, which is one of the first sites in North America that the box tree moth was found. It's the first one in Ohio. And so we've continued to work there. I can tell you that in April we saw larvae. And then since then, I have not seen anything, but we can see evidence that it's been munching along. And this is the caterpillars is what I'm talking about. And so based on last year's data, I'm anticipating in
a few weeks, we probably should see the next generation of moths, at least at my site. So yes, we are seeing them. A lot of people, when they have boxwoods in their yards, they say something's wrong with it and it's dying back. You might have a whole section or a branch. Some of that is actually due to overwintering damage. So it's actually not the box tree moth. It could just be it was a harsh winter or we had a really cold snap and that negatively affected the plants. There's also other types of pests and diseases that can attack the boxwood plants. So right now you see a lot at the tip. There's like this, the leaves sort of cup, they sort of curl up, and that's another type of insect. But all those, including the box tree moth, are actually easily controllable. If someone is willing to, if you want to, do the holistic route, you have to remove the moths physically. There are some chemical sprays that you only want to apply if you see the insects there. And Joe Boggs on the Ohio State Extension newsletters, the Beagle, he calls them. He has a really great series talking about what actually the homeowner can do. Mm-hmm. But again, some people don't like to do chemicals, and you just need to be persistent and pick those off. They have a life cycle about every 2 to 3 weeks.
So, Teresa, what are you finding about which cultivars are most resistant?
Yes, that was your question.
No, you answered my question. I mean, this is a follow-up question. Yeah.
The answer is there are some cultivars that are resistant. And so right now, many of those are currently in production. And so that's why we're testing them. I would say there's probably about 7. And the cultivars look very different. And so some are variegated, some have larger leaves, smaller leaves. And so we're working with a grower from North Carolina, and hopefully those will be commercially available in the next year or two. We're hoping.
Okay.
And there are some others that have some resistance. And so like New Gen Freedom is one, Wintergreen is another. And so there's some that are not 100%, but they are highly resistant.
Yeah. And you were talking about ways to get rid of box tree moth if your boxwoods have that problem. What's the best way for people to monitor for those? Keep an eye out.
Keep looking at your plants. Mm. And I would say not just look at the top of them. You have to like burrow in sometimes, because sometimes the box tree moth and their little caterpillars that get bigger and bigger, they're green with little stripes on them. Oftentimes they're inside. And so if you just walk by and look at your plant, you think it's perfectly fine. And then suddenly overnight, it seems to have been eaten. It's because those little larvae, the little caterpillars have been hanging out in the middle there.
Yeah.
But they don't suck your blood, so we're okay.
Well, Louise, let's talk about some more desirable critters. What are your best tips for making our yards and gardens more pollinator-friendly?
Ooh. So I think this is kind of circling back to how we started. I think it was the mosquito question, how to bring those down. For me, it depends on what your goal is. And if you are trying to attract the best pollinators possible, you want their nectar source. And my fan favorite is the monarch butterfly.
Everybody loves a monarch. Yeah.
And, you know, it's a wonderful, you know, icon to be able to get our, you know, our stories tethered, especially because, you know, if you were to have, I'm bringing this pest back again, but the spotted lanternfly, for example. If you were intending to have your pollinator garden to attract the best native pollinators, well, the book says you have to make sure you get the native plants to attract those specialists. Well, inadvertently, if you have a, one example would be purple echinacea or purple coneflower or echinacea purpurea, pollinator plant can attract your favorite pollinators. But in addition to that, spotted lanternflies get eaten by like the northern cardinal, blue jays, and a couple of more of localized predators. And so for me, it's also, you know, you want to have your native goldenrods, you want to have your asters, you want to have your milkweed varieties. I think something that people apparently, you know, it's not as common knowledge, but milkweeds are poisonous. They have the milkweed that's actually that sap. If you snap it open and it, you know, pours out, it is poisonous. And what happens is that level of toxicity is that it's attractive for monarchs and many other specialists as well. Well, I just read this a couple of days ago, but I was wondering to know if, you know, someone, I read that apparently spotted lanternflies, if they're on your common milkweeds or you have I think it's Asclepia syrica, and then we have Asclepia tuberosa. If you have those, if you have a couple of the Asparta lanternflies that are on them, apparently if they are ingesting part of the plant, that toxicity is not favorable to them. But if you have the host tree, like the Elianthus altissima for the tree of heaven, that tree is not only just harboring that that little critter, it's equipping it to have, you know, you have them, I won't get into a tangent, but we have that tree of heaven everywhere. And it's almost like there's a relationship between some of these pests and a lot of the pollinator trees that we have. And so I'm just wondering, based on what people want, you can go into the rabbit hole with us because we will sure entertain you. But however, you know, if you want to keep it as welcoming as possible, I think there's also a goldenrod, a native goldenrod you can put in your garden. And I will say, I do have a love-hate with goldenrod, the native ones as well. Not hate, but they take over. They're in their own, you know, pockets.
Yeah.
Canada goldenrod is awesome. It's nice, and it blooms during August. But then it starts taking over your pollinator garden. You're like, oh, well, now I got to Chelsea chop it back a bit.
Teresa, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to say exactly the same thing. So I've done some work on monarchs, actually, and milkweeds. And so the best species, of course, is the common milkweed. But even better than that, that does the best for monarch growth and development is the swamp milkweed. And then there's tuberosa, the orange one that you had mentioned, butterfly weed. Mm-hmm. One thing that you don't want to do is plant tropical milkweed. And so that's one that actually the problem, and I think talked about this before on the show, but it's a plant where it doesn't die back naturally at the end of the season. And so the first frost just kills it. So what happens with native milkweeds as they die back, and we call it senescing, they turn yellow and they sort of fall back. That's a signal to the larva of the milkweeds, or of the monarchs rather, that, hey, it's getting time to, you need to fly south to Mexico. And again, the tropical milkweed doesn't do that. So the caterpillars stay on there and the first frost kills them all. But what I was going to is, Louise, I'm so glad you said something about goldenrod, because nectar sources are so important. So oftentimes people are so focused on the milkweed, they forget that the nectar plants are so critically important. So I also have native goldenrod. And yes, I'm also pulling it out all the time. So if anyone wants some native goldenrod, let me know.
Well, Jonathan, we just have a few seconds left, but I want you to talk about fireflies. Let's talk about a bug that brings us joy. Are they okay?
Fireflies are okay. I won't say that they're doing as well as they possibly could be. We have data for about half of the known species in the U.S. that suggests that some of them are in decline or are threatened, but the other half, we don't have enough data to say one way or the other. We do know that insects are in decline. About 60 to 70% of insect biomass has declined over the last 60 years. So that would presumably be affecting them as well. We want people to appreciate them and try and help them out. All of the tips that they provided for pollinators will also help the fireflies in some ways.
Well, I've been talking with University of Kentucky Assistant Professor of Extension Entomology Jonathan Larson, University of Cincinnati's Teresa Cully, and Civic Garden Center's Luis Aguilar-Dwyer. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.